A History of Moral Thought, Lecture 13, Eastern Ethics.
So far, we have confined our exploration of ethics to half the world, the Western half. We've ignored the East, the Orient. But if ethics is universal, we had better look East as well as West, for the same reason we should look at the past as well as the present. We will find a different kind of connection between ethics and religion in the Orient. Ethics is part of philosophy, and in the West, philosophy distinguished itself from religion, due largely to Socrates and his successors. But in the East, there was no Socrates. And so philosophy is not a purely rational science in the East. It's always closely tied to religion. Well, you may wonder then whether they should be called ethical philosophies, since they're not based on reason but faith or religious experience. But if philosophy means the love of wisdom, they could be called philosophies. They could also be called religious if religion means some sort of relation to some sort of absolute being or absolute reality or absolute something. However, Eastern religions are not religions in the sense that Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are religions. That is, except for Bhakti Hinduism, they do not include the following claims: that there is a personal God who created the universe out of nothing, that God revealed himself by written scriptures and historical miracles, that religion is a dialogue between two distinct persons, man and God, that God has a will, that he's a moral commander, and that he gave mankind moral commandments. The four most influential and lasting and popular religions in the East are Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and Taoism. Each of these religions includes a moral code, and the religions and philosophies of the world differ quite significantly on theoretical questions like the nature of God and the relations between God and the world and between God and the soul and between the soul and the body and between spirit and matter, but they don't differ very much on practical questions, questions about practice, about how to live. There is a very impressive agreement about the content of moral goodness. In an earlier lecture, I distinguished three levels of morality. First, pragmatic survival morality, a morality that's a mere means to the end of survival and order. I won't hurt you if you don't hurt me. Second, justice morality, do the right thing just because it's right. Finally, a third level says we should go beyond justice to charity, unselfishness, that the self exists not to have its desires gratified. That's the presupposition of first-level morality, or even to act equally and justly, as in second-level morality, but to give itself away, to forget itself. The meaning of life is to be a saint. Now, almost everyone recognizes level one morality. We need peace and order and survival. And most people recognize level two morality, though not all, especially today, when for the first time many intellectuals deny there are any objective and universal moral absolutes. But I think level two morality is still pretty much in place. But level three morality is rare. Justice, equal rights, that's not rare. But going beyond justice, not just to sentimental love, but to the extent of giving up your very self, that's quite rare. And yet every great religion in the world has taught level three morality. Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, Zoroaster, the Hindu sages, Buddha, Lao Tzu, Confucius, all teach self-forgetfulness, self-giving, self-subordination. All teach some version of the paradox that to find yourself, you must lose yourself. Yet, although the content of ethics in the Eastern religious traditions is high or idealistic, third level, yet the status of ethics, the role of ethics in these religions, tends to be lower or less than in Western religions. In this sense, in Western religions, moral behavior comes from all the way up and goes all the way up. It's commanded by God, and it's our response to God, our response to ultimate reality, since God has a will and God is a moralist. The ultimate reason for human morality is God, whether it's his will or his nature. Over and over again in the Jewish scriptures, especially the book of Deuteronomy, God repeats, "You must be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy." Now, in Eastern religions, we must also be holy, but not for that reason. Morality doesn't go all the way up. At a certain stage in the climb up the mountain to God, morality is left behind, like the first stages of a multi-stage rocket, or like a ladder that you use to climb onto the roof. You don't need it anymore once you're on the roof. In Eastern religions, the purpose of morality is to wipe the bad dust off the mirror of the human mind so that we can see God, so that we can have mystical experience. The goal of Eastern religions is mysticism. The goal of Western religions is sanctity. In the East, the moral will has to be purified so that the mind is clear. In the West, the mind has to be enlightened so that the will can be better. In Hinduism, the ultimate reality is called Brahman. In some Hindu traditions, like Bhakti Yoga and the Bhagavad Gita, Brahman is a person to be loved and trusted. In the other Hindu traditions, Brahman is not a person, but simply the one and only reality of which we are all manifestations. The ultimate end of Hinduism is realizing our unity with Brahman, realizing that in the depths of our soul, or Atman, we are all one, like a single undersea continent, even though it appears on the surface to be separate islands. And that one that we really all are is Brahman, God, infinite and absolute and indefinable perfection. The expression of this unity of Atman to Brahman is the formula Thou art that, Tat Tvam Asi in Sanskrit. Atman is Brahman. There are four different roads to Brahman, four different yogas to the realization of unity with Brahman. The word yoga means deed or work, or yoking to a task, a way of life. All are interior journeys of self-discovery that lead to Atman and thus to Brahman, but they're for different personalities. Each includes a moral code, and the moral codes are similar. Purification from all kinds of evil and impurity and selfishness, but the psychological emphases differ. Jnana Yoga is a mental, intellectual path by which you learn to understand yourself differently. You learn to detach your thoughts from your body and your ego and its desires. You learn to identify yourself with the universal observing mind, or Brahman. Karma Yoga is a path to Brahman through ordinary daily work, fulfilling your karmic duties with a new motive, not for the hope of personal happiness by fulfilling your desires, but sheer obedience to your fate, your karma, in the mind of Brahman. Bhakti Yoga is a personal, emotional path of love and attachment to Brahman instead of yourself. And finally, Raja Yoga is a careful, difficult, detailed, experimental path, like turning your life into a spiritual laboratory. It combines elements of all the others. Ethics is somewhat different on the four different yoga paths. The role of the mind is obviously primary in Jnana Yoga, and the role of emotion and personal attachment is primary in Bhakti Yoga, and the role of work and purity of motive in work is primary in Karma Yoga. But they all have the same goal, detachment from selfishness and attainment of unselfconsciousness. The explanation of what happens then differ. Some Hindus believe that you then see that you simply are Brahman, while other Hindus believe that you then attain union with Brahman, a kind of spiritual marriage, a little closer to Orthodox Jewish and Christian mysticism. The theologies differ, even within the one religion of Hinduism, and certainly between different world religions, but the ethics is quite similar. Probably the major specific difference between Hindu ethics and most Western ethics concerns the value of individual human life. If a pious Hindu sees someone dying in the street, he will not necessarily try to save him, because that might be interfering with his karma. This life is not the only one, so this man is only passing out of one body and will soon get another one by reincarnation. Here is one example of the way a theological belief, reincarnation, makes a difference to ethics. There are two theological beliefs that make a great difference here, the Christian idea of the incarnation and the Hindu idea of reincarnation. The incarnation means the belief that Jesus of Nazareth was literally God become man, and that this man was in fact the eternal, perfect, all-good, all-knowing, all-powerful creator, the mind of God, or the Son of God, or the Logos of God. Well, if God became man, man is raised as high as anything can possibly go. You don't have to believe in the truth of this Christian doctrine to see that it is the strongest possible reason for belief in the dignity of man, and the dignity of women, too, for no other religion has ever called a woman the mother of God. The other theological doctrine that makes a difference to moral values and the value of individual human life in particular is the Hindu doctrine of reincarnation, that after you die, your soul gets another human body and comes back to Earth to learn the lessons you didn't learn the last time around, to fulfill your karma, your destiny, and cosmic justice, to reap the rewards for virtue and the punishments for vice from your last life. Just as the Christian doctrine of the incarnation of God in man makes man and life on earth much more precious than common sense takes it to be, the Hindu doctrine of reincarnation makes it less important, less final than common sense takes it to be. I don't mean this as a criticism or an evaluation, just a description. I think Hindus would agree with that description, would say that we Westerners, whether religious or secular, take ourselves and our lives on earth and our individualities and our individual deaths much too seriously, that we should fear death less and love life less than we do, because both are only temporary and repeatable. But the West thinks they're not repeatable. If you believe that you only go around once in life, then you'll take that life much more seriously. That's true for both the believer in individual life after death in heaven and for those who don't believe in life after death, because for both, this is the only earthly life you get, so you'd better get it right. As the old beer commercial said, you only go around once in life, so live it with gusto. But if you believe in reincarnation, it's like taking a test with endless chances to retake it if you fail. If you don't believe in reincarnation, it's like taking a final exam with no chance to retake it. And that difference has produced a big cultural difference between life in the West and life in the East, especially in India. India is very patient. The West is very impatient. We have more hospitals, but also more wars. Our ethics emphasizes right action. It's more involved and practical. Hindu ethics emphasizes right understanding. It's more detached and contemplative. Buddhism is an offshoot of Hinduism, a kind of simplified and purified Hinduism. Buddha's ethics, summarized in his Noble Eightfold Path, is similar to Raja Yoga in Hinduism, but Buddhism rejects the Hindu theory of Brahman and Atman. Buddhism is either atheist or agnostic about Brahman, and it denies that there is an Atman, or a spiritual substance called the soul. It says that our belief that we have souls, or egos, or selves, stems from our practice of selfish desire. If we stopped desiring, we'd stop thinking that there was anyone there doing the desiring. So the ultimate end of Buddhist ethics is to stop all selfish desire, to purify our thoughts and actions from selfishness, in order to reach the state of consciousness called nirvana. Nirvana means extinction. Extinction of selfish desire, and thus of self-consciousness, and therefore of suffering. Because suffering comes from selfish desire, according to Buddhism. Now, most of us in the West agree with Buddhists that selfish desire is bad. But we do not agree that the self is an illusion, and that ending self-consciousness is the ultimate good. We do like the idea of salvation from suffering, of course, but not at the expense of salvation from joy and love and happiness, too, which is the price you have to pay if the very idea of the self is extinguished. For it is the same self that both suffers and enjoys, both hates and loves, is both bad and good. Once you reach nirvana, you are not good or bad. You simply are not. So even though there is a strict ethics on the Noble Eightfold Path to reach nirvana, and one that is quite similar to much of Western ethics, it exists only to be transcended. It is not a way of perfecting the self, but of destroying it, or rather destroying the illusion that there is a self. There are different schools of thought and different emphases within Buddhism, but the essence of Buddhism, as summarized by Buddha himself in the 6th century BC, is the Four Noble Truths. First, that all life is infected with suffering, or dukkha. To live is to suffer. Second, that the cause of suffering, the reason we suffer, is because of greed, or grasping, or tanha. We have selfish desires, and that sets up a gap between desire and satisfaction. And that gap is what suffering is, wanting what you don't have. In the words of a very popular philosopher, you can't always get what you want. Or another line, I can't get no satisfaction. Buddha diagnoses the cause of that symptom as desire. Third noble truth, to eliminate the effect, eliminate the cause. So the way to extinguish suffering is to extinguish selfish desire. Nirvana, or extinction, is the prognosis, the cure. But how do you do that? You need a prescription, And that's the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the fourth noble truth, the way to the extinction of selfish desires. In the Noble Eightfold Path, life is divided into eight aspects, and egoism is deliberately reduced to zero in each part. Inner consciousness, outer consciousness, desire, occupation, friends, etc. Buddhism is a way of salvation, but not salvation from sin, as Christianity is, but from suffering. There is no notion of sin, or of a divine law, or a divine will to sin against, or even a personal God in Buddhism. So just as in Hinduism, ethics does not go all the way up in Buddhism, as it does in Christianity and Judaism and Islam, where there is a God who is good and a moralist. Here's a story to show the striking similarity between Buddhist ethics and Christian ethics, despite the striking dissimilarity between their theologies and religions and metaphysics. The story comes from the 10th or 11th century, from Tibet. A pious Buddhist was meditating alone before a gold statue of Buddha in a monastery in Tibet in the middle of winter. He had on two robes, and there was a fire in his fireplace. A thief came in from the storm outside, noticed the gold Buddha, and noticed that the monk was in a trance, so he stole the statue. But as he was leaving, he noticed the monk's nice yellow robe, so he stole that too, off his body. This woke the monk up, and the monk chased the thief out into the snow and caught him. But instead of calling the police, the monk gave the thief his second robe. He said, "I kept calling you to stop, but you wouldn't listen. You need this second robe more than I do. Your job requires you to be out on the road in the middle of winter, but I have a nice warm fireplace. Here, take this second robe too." The thief said, "You must be a crazy man." "No, I'm a Buddhist monk." "Well, I think you're crazy." "I will explain to you why I'm not crazy. Tell me, suppose you were out in this storm and you had two gloves on your right hand and nothing on your left hand, and your left hand was freezing. What would you do?" The thief said, "I'd put one of the gloves on my left hand, of course." "And would that act be crazy?" "No." "Well, then I am not crazy either, because that's exactly what I've just done." The thief understood, and he was so impressed with this wisdom that he came back to the monastery and learned to be a pious Buddhist himself. Now, one of the fascinating things about that story is how closely it resembles a Christian story from the 6th century in France about St. Martin of Tours. It's a story Victor Hugo used as a model in Les Misérables for his pious priest who gave Jean Valjean his silverware to save him from being arrested. St. Martin was a rich but pious bishop, and a thief stole some gold from him, and the police caught the thief and brought St. Martin into the town square to identify the thief. And Martin said, "Yes, that is my gold, but this man ran away so fast that I forgot to give him the rest of my gift, my coat. Here, my poor man, you need this coat more than I do." And he took the coat off his back and gave it to the thief. The behavior is strikingly similar, and strikingly unusual. It's as if Buddhist saints and Christian saints share some strange secret. But their explanations are strikingly different. When St. Martin explained to the thief later why he did this, he said, "With this gold I have bought your soul for Christ. It is Christ who did this deed to you, through me. You must learn to live for Christ as I have. You must learn charity. You must learn to save others as Christ has saved you." But the Buddhist explanation was simply rational and impersonal. The Christian explanation was personal. I and you and your soul and Christ as real persons, all of which Buddhism denies. Yet, the two strikingly dissimilar religions produce strikingly similar kinds of lives. The two greatest virtues for Buddhism are wisdom and compassion, or prajna and karuna. Wisdom means enlightenment, overcoming the illusion of distinct individuality, and compassion means feeling one with all suffering beings. Karuna, or Buddhist compassion, is not the same as agape or Christian charity. They both negate the same thing, selfishness, but they don't both affirm the same thing. Karuna is empathy with all suffering beings, a feeling or intuition. Agape is active love, willing the good of the other, an act of the will. And here's a second difference. Both karuna and agape are to be given to all people, both good and bad, but karuna is to be given to animals too, equally with humans, because they suffer too. This is illustrated by the following Buddhist story. Two Buddhists were fishing. The first, who was enlightened, saw a lizard come up out of the water and attach itself to his hand and start to suck his blood. but he didn't pull his hand back. He fed the lizard his own blood, out of compassion for the lizard, who was starving. The second Buddhist, who was not enlightened, said, "Don't you know what that lizard is? It's poisonous." The first replied, "Don't you know who that lizard is? It's me." So in Buddhism, as in Hinduism, there is not the great priority put on human life and human individuality, and certainly not on human bodily salvation, which there is in the West by both Western religions and Western secularism. Here is a Buddhist story about love and hate. Buddhist ethics agrees with the West that hate is very bad, but it does not agree that love, charity, agape, is as good. Certainly not that it is the ultimate good, the highest value. In the story, an inexperienced sailor who couldn't swim took out his sailboat on a large lake. A storm came up, and he tried to get the boat back to dock, but every time he approached the dock, another sailboat got in his way, so he had to retreat. Finally, the wind got so bad that his boat toppled over. As he began to sink, the offending boat passed near him again, and he raised his fist in anger at the irresponsible sailor who had cost him his life, but he couldn't see who was sailing the boat. He sank down, then bobbed up again and saw the boat a second time, and shook his fist at it, but he couldn't see the sailor. Finally, just before he went down for the third time and drowned, he saw the boat a third time, and this time it was close enough to see who was sailing it. No one. It was empty. He had no one to hate. So he unclutched his fist and died in peace. The boat is the body. The sailor is the soul, the self, the ego. There is no ego, according to Buddhism. We are empty boats, driven by the wind. There is no one there to hate. And when we see that, we can no longer hate. But the price you have to pay for that is that there is also no one there to love. Confucian ethics is much less mystical than Hindu or Buddhist ethics, and much more practical and political. Its central idea is harmony. Justice does not mean equality or rights, but a kind of social music, each person singing the note that is right for them. Confucius took this central idea of harmony and constructed a social ethic that transformed China from a period of civil war to relative peace and unity and stability for over 2,000 years, until Mao Zedong, history's greatest mass murderer, destroyed it and replaced it with the opposite philosophy, communism, which is based on class conflict and totalitarian force. Confucius was not much of a success in his lifetime, just like Socrates, yet his influence is unparalleled in history. For 2,000 years, every Chinese schoolchild imbibed Confucian principles for every aspect of life at every hour of the day. Confucius was probably the single most successful thinker in the field of social ethics in the history of the world. I think most Americans would find it impossibly oppressive and narrow and artificial to live in a Confucian society. Everything is done like an 18th century ball, with elaborate correctness. There is a right way to address your older brother, which is different than the way to address your older sister, and also different from the way to address your younger brother, and so forth. But it worked. Another thing we would find very different about Confucian ethics is that its basic unit is not the individual, but the family. The individual is subordinated to the extended family. Preserving family loyalties and honor is primary. Individual happiness is secondary. And surprisingly, this system seems to have satisfied more individuals than any other in history, in the world's largest nation for the longest time. Another thing we would find alien is the very great emphasis placed on tradition and respect for the old. We're a youth culture. Confucianism envies the old more than the young, because it values what the old are better at, wisdom, more highly than what the young are better at, pleasure or health. In fact, there's so much respect for ancestors that they are almost worshipped. Perhaps the most pervasive difference between Confucian ethics and Western ethics is this, where the genius of the West is to distinguish things. Ever since Judaism and Christianity distinguished the creator and the creation, and good and evil, much more sharply than paganism had done, and to define things clearly and logically ever since Socrates. In contrast, it is the genius of the East, especially in Confucianism, to join things and people, to mediate and compromise. A striking social indication of this difference is the fact that America has only 4% of the world's people, but 75% of the world's lawyers, while China has 20% of the world's people, but only 1% of the world's lawyers. Confucianism is opposite to Taoism in many ways. Its founder Lao Tzu was a romantic and a mystic, whereas Confucius was a rational pragmatist. Confucius met Lao Tzu once and afterwards said, "I know a monkey and a fox and a rat when I meet one, but today I have met a dragon." We know very little about Lao Tzu. His name means only the old guy. He left civilized China, like Thoreau leaving for Walden Pond, riding off on a water buffalo, disenchanted with the rules and regulations of Confucianism. But the gatekeeper at the Great Wall, who had heard of his wisdom, wouldn't let him pass through till he paid, not in money, but in wisdom. So Lao Tzu got down off his water buffalo, tossed off 81 short poems, gave them to the gatekeeper, and left, never to be heard of again. Those 81 poems constitute the Tao Te Ching, which is the second most popular book in the world, next to the Bible. Not only Taoists, of whom there are very few even in China, but Confucians and Buddhists and Hindus and even Christians love the book. Many parts of it sound like Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Qing means book or classic. De, which is also one of the five most important moral virtues in Confucianism, means spiritual power, and Dao means way. It means the way ultimate reality works, and therefore also, in the second place, the way nature works in manifestation of ultimate reality. Learning from nature is the key to Taoist ethics. And finally, also, in the third place, the way or lifestyle of the wise individual and the wise society that imitates the way or patterns or style of nature, just as nature imitates the eternal Tao. That pattern is similar to Christian charity and Hindu-Buddhist mysticism in that it is self-giving, yielding. The greatest power, or te, according to Taoism, is in the feminine side of our being, our womb-like receptivity. Rigid things die, flexible things live. The great strong oak tree breaks in the hurricane, but the weak little willow tree does not. The favorite Taoist model in nature is water. Water always goes to the lowest place, the humblest place, and it has no form of its own. It takes the form of its containers. Yet it's the source of all life, and its waves, dashing themselves to extinction on the hard rocks, are not changed by the rocks, but the rocks are changed by it, in fact turned to sand after millions of years, because water is so patient. The Tao Te Ching is full of images of the power of the Tao, like the emptiness at the center of a bowl, or the doors and windows that are useful precisely because they're not full and hard, but empty. So if we let our spirit be empty, we too will have the power of the Tao, and it will work through us. When the first Japanese mountain climbing team conquered Mount Everest, they stopped 50 feet from the summit and went back down, out of respect for the mountain. Asked why, they said, "We did not climb to conquer Everest, but to befriend her." That's like the Tao, humble. Taoism would see the modern Western ideal of man's conquest of nature by technology as absurd and impossible. The Tao Te Ching says, "Nature is a sacred vessel. Those who only want to use her do not succeed." Nature is your mother. You don't conquer your mother. One of the movements in Western thought today that owes a lot to Taoism is sometimes called deep ecology, as distinct from merely pragmatic, practical, conservationist ecology. Taoism never took much in China, except as a protest movement. The Confucians were the responsible establishment, the main culture. The Taoists were the counterculture. Together they made an odd couple, complementing each other like Mars and Venus, left brain and right brain, classical and romantic, practical and mystical, or to use the Chinese terms, yin and yang. Eastern ethics, especially in Taoism, takes its standard from nature, from the law of yin and yang. We find this in nature, mutually dependent pairs, light and dark, hot and cold, male and female, and also life and death. At the heart of life, there is death. As soon as we're born, we begin to die. Or as Jim Morrison says, nobody gets out of here alive. Socrates made the same point in a joke on his deathbed. After receiving the poison, his sentence of execution, his last words to his disciple Crito were, "Crito, we owe a cock to Asclepius. Be sure to pay the debt." Asclepius was the god of healing. Pious Greeks who had a life-threatening illness slept in his temple overnight, and if they were healed, they attributed it to this god. The thank-offering for the god's rescue from death was a sheep if you were rich, and a cock if you were poor, like Socrates. But there is no mention of Socrates ever being sick. And the god did not rescue him from death. He died, less than a minute after telling Crito to pay this debt to the god. But Socrates' point was the same as Jim Morrison's. This world is a world of death, and now he was being delivered from it. Socrates' implied point is that at the heart of this life there is death, and at the heart of death there is new life, immortal life, heavenly life, like yin and yang. I think there's great wisdom in this, but I think something is missing. I think moral good and evil are in one way not like physical life and death. Life depends on death, but good does not depend on evil. Life does depend on death. If some of us don't shuffle off this mortal coil, there'll be no room for others to arrive. But good does not depend on evil. You don't have to be wicked in order to be virtuous. Unless ultimate reality is like that, both bad and good, unless even God has a dark side, as in George Lucas's Hindu theology in the Star Wars trilogy, where Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's father. In other words, where the hero is not the son of God, but more like the son of Satan. Or, to be more exact, where good and evil both go all the way up. Vishnu is the creator, and Shiva is the destroyer, and that's Brahman. Or else, where neither of them go all the way up, and ultimate reality is beyond good and evil, as in Buddhism. But in the West, rooted as it is in Jewish and Christian and Muslim theology, ultimate reality, or God, is good and not evil. He does not have a dark side. And the meaning of life is being like him. And he discriminates between good and evil, and tells us to choose good and reject evil. So morality is taken with ultimate seriousness, because it's rooted in something ultimate. It's the absolute essence of the good for Plato. It's God for Jews, Christians, and Muslims. It's the rational, universal, necessary, unchangeable, abstract a priori of the categorical imperative for Kant. So whether it's pre-Christian or Christian or post-Christian, the West tends to moral absolutism. Morality is not relative to immorality, as yin is relative to yang. There have been philosophies in the West which have disagreed with this. The Sophists and the Epicureans in ancient Greece and Rome, and Machiavelli and the Utilitarians in the modern West. But up till recently, they have been the minority. They probably still are among the masses, but not among the intellectuals. And that's probably one reason why Oriental philosophies are more popular and fashionable today at the same time as moral relativism is replacing moral absolutism. And this raises the question of the future of ethics in Western civilization, and the future of that civilization itself, and the connection between those two things. Can our civilization survive without its traditional ethical foundations? That is the question we will think about for the last lecture.
After listening to Lecture 13, a student posed this question to Professor Kraft. How do you explain the similarities in the ethical systems of so many different religions? Let's listen to the professor's response.
It's a real puzzle to account for the striking similarity between, for instance, Buddhist ethics and Christian ethics, if they're not derived from a similar religion or theology, and if there's no historical connection. They're not copied from each other. So where do they come from? I said something about the Buddhist and the Christian, and basically all religious saints and mystics, having a common secret. Where do they get that secret from? Well, Plato would explain it in terms of a kind of innate unconscious knowledge, something like Jung's collective unconsciousness. And if you pierce through that, anyone can see it at any time and any place. There seems to be something to that. I could account for that in two ways, vertically or horizontally, so to speak. Vertically, if God created us in his own image, then maybe he put in us a kind of mental resemblance, a kind of set of almost genetic tendencies to think these right thoughts. Or horizontally, if once we were more perfect and innocent and close to God than we are now, if something like the story of the Garden of Eden is true, then maybe there's a kind of collective racial unconscious memory of that. And if that is true, that would explain another puzzle, why we are so disenchanted with the world, why we all have a lover's quarrel with the world. Pascal says we're like disinherited princes. We're not satisfied until we get back on the throne. But we never were on the throne in our memory. Well, maybe we were way back beyond our memory.
This ends Lecture 13.